Hello and welcome to the BBC History Magazine podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the Deputy Editor.
And I'm Charlotte Hodgman, the Section Editor.
This is our January 2011 podcast. Happy New Year. Coming up this month, we have...
Towards the middle of the 9th century, Viking activities really pick up and they have a major effect on the politics of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
That was Ryan Lavelle on Fighting the Vikings.
Shore people knew much about this forgotten navy of seafarers, even though they supplied much of the nation's fish.
That was Rob Robinson on Edwardian fishing fleets.
Stand in front of that stone and just think to yourself that that weighed 100 tonnes. It was put up probably somewhere around 5,000 years ago with people without the use of metal tools and implements.
And that was Nicholas Snashall on the archaeology of Avebury.
This monthly podcast is produced by the team behind BBC History Magazine, the UK's best-selling history magazine.
Before we start, I have a couple of announcements. First, I'd like to thank everyone who voted for us in the Euro Podcast Awards, where we've been fortunate to win the UK professional category. Secondly, I'd like to tell you that we've rebranded our website. You can now find our online presence at www.historyextra.com. BBC History Magazine continues to be published 13 times a year, but if you'd like to read the magazine digitally, there is now a digital version available for computers and Apple iPads. You can visit www.historyextra.com/digital for more on that. Well, the start of the Viking era in Britain is traditionally ascribed to the year 793 AD, when the Anglo-Saxon monastery of Lindisfarne was ransacked. In this month's issue, Ryan Lavelle has written about the Anglo-Saxon defence against the Vikings and the experience of warfare in this period. Our editor Dave Musgrove caught up with him.
So, I'm sat here outside the British Museum on a lovely wintry day. I'm sat with Ryan Lavelle, who's an Anglo-Saxon and Viking expert. And we're going to have a chat about the experience of warfare in the Viking Age. Now, the first thing I think we need to establish is what do we mean by Viking Age?
Viking Age is really the period where you start to get activity coming from Scandinavia, raiding activity, of course trading activity, and that basically begins at the very end of the 8th century, where the first Viking raid in England is in 793. And towards the middle of the 9th century, Viking activities really pick up and they have a major effect on the politics of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. In fact, knocking out three of the main dynasties in Anglo-Saxon England to leave one major dynasty in Wessex in the south of England. Yeah.
Which takes us on to the famous story of Alfred and the defence against...
It does indeed, yes. Yeah. The book which I've recently published is called Alfred's Wars, and effectively by the title it highlights the fact that Alfred the Great of Wessex, King of Wessex in the later 9th century, managed to hold on to his kingdom and managed to undertake some reforms of military systems in his kingdom. And the history of Anglo-Saxon England until the Norman Conquest basically reflects the legacy of some of those military reforms. Yeah. So some of the campaigns that are possible by Alfred's successors are possible because of the legacy that Alfred had left and the sort of military systems that had been developed during the 9th century.
And the Viking period ends in 1066.
The Viking, yes.
Is that a fair assessment?
That's a fair assessment, yes, yeah. 1066 is a nice stopping point for the Viking Age because that's the point when Harald Hardrada, the King of Norway, was killed at the Battle of Stamford Bridge. Yeah. So in British history, we often like our kind of moments in history, and 1066 is a moment in history not just because of the Norman Conquest, but because the last major Viking leader, the last significant Viking king, is killed in battle.
Yeah.
But there are periods of peace in the period from the 9th to the 11th centuries. It's not a period where everybody is at war all the time. There are some major campaigns. We get the impression from some sources like legal sources that there are what we could call feuding taking place in some places. So sort of private warfare undertaken by local lords, for example. So there are sort of degrees of violence, but I wouldn't say that it's a complete picture. I wouldn't say it's a picture of warfare for a whole 250 year period across the British Isles, but there are some very nasty things that seem to happen during this period.
Is it a notably more violent period than other times, or is that just something that you can't even get in your head from the association with the word Viking?
I think it is something that we get in our head from the association of the word Viking. Yeah. The Viking activities of the 9th century and the Viking activities in the late 10th and early 11th centuries, when some major invasions are launched, those activities are pretty violent and have a big political impact. So that's the sort of significance of where Vikings come into British history during the early Middle Ages.
So was the fighting at the time carried out by the upper classes?
Warfare is an aristocratic activity in that period. Status comes from the ability to prove oneself in war. It comes from the holding of weapons. It comes from the ability to hold land as well. But often that land holding might be associated with that kind of status as a noble who's capable of fighting in warfare as well. So the kind of front end of combat is one which is undertaken by the better off people, because the equipment that is needed to take part in a battle is expensive. That doesn't mean to say that the sort of lower classes, for want of a better term, that doesn't mean to say that the ordinary people didn't necessarily participate in the actual combat side of things, but I suspect that would be a small number of people, maybe carrying bows and arrows, or with sort of minor roles in the battlefields. Warfare in this period, as it is in many historical periods, is about the assertion of status. It's about the assertion of masculine status as well.
So for the most part, it would have been that sort of the big men of society who could afford the kit to go and stand on the battlefield and hit each other.
Effectively, yes, yeah. Yes. I don't know whether they are all necessarily actually fighting per se and actually hitting each other, but actually being seen to be able to hit each other and being seen to take part in a military campaign, I think, is one of the significant things.
It's a big status thing for these people. They've got to show that they have the money and to show willing to actually go and stand on the battlefield.
That's right. Yes, they need to show that ability to take part.
And is there, in the piece you've written for the magazine, you talk a little about sort of the ritual side of battles and how there may have been certain elements of battle that had to, that had to be fulfilled. And you talk specifically about this idea about the Anglo-Saxons not fighting on horseback because they wanted to stand on the battlefield and say, I am not moving from here. So are there rituals that need to be fulfilled for battles at this time?
Yes, I get that impression. The notion of fighting on foot in particular occasions might be when the occasion demands it, when a show of resistance needs to be made, like at the famous Battle of Maldon in 991,
yeah.
Or indeed at the Battle of Hastings as well, where there's that sense of resistance against the invader. It's very difficult to see how rituals might be undertaken on the battlefield, because the evidence for the battlefield itself and conduct on the battlefield is limited.
Yeah.
But things like prayer before a battle are important, as the life of King Alfred, the contemporary 9th century life of King Alfred, makes evident in the description of the Battle of Ashdown. Also, things like the group of Vikings seizing the assembly point at Skutjamanob in 1006 indicates that particular places in the landscape had a meaning, and that meaning of the landscape, that meaning of the control of landscape, might be sort of conferred upon conduct in a battle, and the ability to win a battle is linked to that control of a landscape.
Yeah.
So I think things like negotiation before a battle and the shouting of insults, I think there the Battle of Maldon poem probably hits upon some historical reality there. It hits right. upon some historical values, some expected values within society.
Yeah.
And that sort of geeing up of both sides, the sort of gathering of the gathering of bravery, the gathering of the sense of strength, the sense of group identity is part of that yeah. ritual of battle. Of course, the Vikings weren't pagans in the way that these the Scandinavian sagas sort of have the first spear being thrown dedicated to Odin,
yeah.
You know, issues like that in the saga descriptions of battle, but we might expect sort of similar group activities being undertaken in order to sort of build a group's cohesion before they actually sort of make the push into the actual violence of battle.
So am I right in getting a picture in my head of Anglo-Saxons assembled on one side of a field and Vikings on the other, and then before any blood is shed, there's a lot of fairly fearsome heckling.
I think more than fearsome heckling, in an oral society the shouting of insults could possibly actually be an artistic medium you could suggest as well, but I mean that's speculation, but I think the notion of the two sides cheering each other on, cheering themselves on rather,
yeah.
Before the battle and heckling the other side. Yes, I think that's an entirely plausible scenario for the period.
Well, that leads on to another point, which has always struck me as quite odd about this period, is you tend to see the English, the Anglo-Saxons, as victims and losers in this. They always seem to be on the wrong end of a beating. Now, in other senses, they don't seem like particularly retiring, non-warlike sort of folk. So, is that a fallacy? Were they actually more evenly matched than we tend to think, or were they just not up for the fight with the Vikings? And if so, why?
I get the impression that they're evenly matched at some points in the 9th, 10th, 11th centuries. For example, during the wars of Athelstan, they basically. The first king of England, effectively, yep. is Athelstan, and during those wars, the Anglo-Saxons are going from one successful campaign to the next, fighting the Northumbrian Viking dynasty, fighting the Kingdom of the Scots, the warriors who had taken part in those campaigns were probably motivated by the ability to gain wealth, to gain booty. Effectively from those successful campaigns, and Athelstan's campaigns had led on from campaigns during the reign of his father, during the reign of Edward the Elder and Edward the Elder's sister Athelflaed of the Mercians, and there'd been some very successful campaigns there as well. So broadly speaking, for the first half of the 10th century there are some very successful aggressive campaigns
yeah.
undertaken against the neighbours of a largely West Saxon dominated English kingdom. Now, during the reign of Edgar the Peaceable, as he's come to be known, there's a period where basically there are no major campaigns. There's a very large English fleet, which may well have been manned in part by Scandinavians who were paid for with English money.
Uh-huh.
And that period of peace may well have led to a generation of of warriors who may have been confident when they're seeing off a few Viking raids in the early years of Ethelred's reign, may even have been very confident at the beginning of the Battle of Maldon in 991 as well. But possibly their military abilities, because they may not have had the same experience, may not have been quite up to it. However, that being said, the Welsh annals, the Annales Cambriae, record a number of English incursions into Wales. So during periods of apparent peace, there are still Anglo-Saxon raiding activities in Wales as well. So small-scale warfare still carries on. But whether that's quite enough to sort of see off Viking fleets who have fought together and lived together for. Viking ships crews who've been together for long periods, whether that's quite enough to actually be able to match those might be questionable.
That moves on to another point, which you touch on in the piece that you've written for the magazine, which is why the English didn't take the fight to the Vikings, why they didn't get in their ships and sail to Scandinavia and sock it to them there.
Yeah.
Why not?
I often wonder about that, actually. I think it's because the Vikings, although we call them the Vikings as a sort of single group, there may be a group identity on one level, but on another level, in terms of personal allegiances, in terms of where the Vikings had come from, they weren't a single unified group. So this was something that Charlemagne had discovered in going into Saxony in the 8th century, that basically you get small groups of effectively tribal groupings, and it's very difficult to actually take over an entire territory and subjugate an entire territory. Now, the Saxons were neighbours of the Franks, over whom Charlemagne ruled. The Vikings from modern-day Denmark, Sweden, Norway, were basically... A distance across the North Sea from the English, so it's not like Alfred or Ethelred could have gathered together a very large army and gone to Oslo and taken over a large territory as a result of that. That said, the fight is taken to the Vikings. It's taken to the Vikings in terms of the Kingdom of York and that was established in the late 9th century in Northumbria, which was effectively an Anglo-Scandinavian kingdom.
And just in conclusion, do the Vikings at any point become more of a soft touch as the period goes on? Do they lose any of their sort of warlike edge? That's one of the theories, isn't it? They come, they settle down, and they decide that they quite like it, and they don't want to be fighting all the time.
Yeah, it's difficult to say how far the people that we say are Vikings in Britain were actually necessarily of Scandinavian descent. Now, archaeologists are much more into these kind of debates than I'm able to talk about. But effectively, some of those territories that become Viking kingdoms very quickly take up the habits of Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. So they then become effectively, I wouldn't say sedentary kingdoms, but they become established kingdoms in the manner of Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. I've just been saying that the English in the Anglo-Saxon period, or many of the English aristocrats in the Anglo-Saxon period, have a warlike edge. So to say the Vikings would lose their warlike edge, I think would be to do them a disservice, really.
Ryan Lavelle is a lecturer at Winchester University. You can read his feature in the January issue. His book, Alfred's Wars, Sources and Interpretations of Anglo-Saxon Warfare in the Viking Age, is published by Boydell.
In 2009, a collection of tinted photographs depicting life on the North Sea boxing fleets was discovered at a house sale in London. The unique images give a rare insight into the harsh and often treacherous conditions experienced by 19th century trawlermen who spent weeks at sea without even basic amenities. I spoke to Rob Robinson, a lecturer at the Maritime Historical Studies Centre at the University of Hull, about these remarkable men and found out how a small fleet of English trawlers almost caused a war with Russia in 1904. So, Rob, what were the boxing fleets and why have they become a focus of study for you?
The boxing fleets were a collection or a fleet that worked far out in the North Sea. When they caught the fish, these trawlers, they packed them in boxes on board the trawlers and then ferried them across to fast steam cutters, which took them to shore. That's why they got the name boxing fleet. They were different from an ordinary trawler in the fact that they would stay out on the fishing grounds for weeks and weeks and just transfer their fish went every day to one of these cutters, which would take it in shore, whereas an ordinary trawler would return to shore perhaps every week from the North Sea. One of the reasons I really got engaged and interested in this particular fleet in the first place was because both my grandfather and great-grandfather, who were fishermen, both worked on these boxing fleets. And I've been able to find out a great deal more about their sort of life and work.
What in particular interested you about the fleets?
Well, what was particularly interesting about it was the sort of fascinating nature of the work at sea. They were forgotten people, these, who worked these fleets. They worked far from shore. They were out of sight of land. People didn't know what was going on. They worked in the most difficult of circumstances. They would be trawling almost relentlessly whenever weather conditions permitted, and that was most of the time, really, because they could trawl in bad weather. And then they had to deal with the fish every day, and the most perilous job of all was to transfer the fish from the trawlers across to the cutters. You had to do this in an open rowing boat, in all sorts of weathers, and carry the boxes. And then when you got alongside the cutter, one of your crew had to jump on board, regardless of weather conditions, and then help with the transfer of the fish. So it was an incredibly difficult and hazardous job, and many people knew very little about it.
And what sort of luxuries would they have had at sea?
Luxuries, very few, really. The meals were very basic. I mean, obviously, you ate quite a lot of fish. But another sort of regular thing that they would eat at sea would be they would take lumps of salt beef with them. And quite often, they would tow these behind the trawler for a few days to help reduce the amount of salt in the beef. So meals were basic. There was lots of very substantial food in terms of things like carbohydrate and the like that would give them energy, but nothing fancy. Nothing fancy at all. And the living conditions were pretty primitive as well.
Was anything done to make life easier and more enjoyable for them?
Shore people knew much about this forgotten navy of seafarers, even though they supplied much of the nation's fish. But one day, a chap called William Mather, who sailed out of London to visit these fleets, when he got there, he was shocked by the conditions that they worked under. He visited several of the trawlers, saw people. He realised that quite often people got injured at sea. They had no treatment or anything like that to help them out. And when he came back to land, he was fired up with a desire to help them. And he formed the Mission for Deep Sea Fishermen, which later became Royal and Nationals. And today we still have the Royal National Mission for Deep Sea Fishermen. And in those days, its job was to help the boxing fleet. They arranged for a hospital ship to sail amongst the fleets, ministering to the sick and the injured, and help to supply them with basic commodities. Luxury in those days was tobacco. No drink at sea. But they could get books, and they could have somewhere to meet, and they occasionally would get treated in other ways, and they had hospital facilities.
What sort of men would have made up the crews? What sort of hierarchy was there on board the ship?
Well, typically there were about 10 men in these boxing fleet crews. There would be a skipper. He was a man who had all the skills of, you know, being able to manage a group of men, navigate a ship, but he also had the skills of being a hunter. He knew where to look for fish. He knew the habits of the fish, etc. So he was the chief man on board. Below him was a mate, and the mate had an important job. He looked after the crew and a lot of the work on the deck as well. There would be a man called a bosun. Then there would be deckhands. There would be a cook. But equally important, in the days of steam trawlers, there was the engineer and the trimmers. And that was a particular job. If you were a fireman trimmer, you had the job of stoking the furnaces of the steam engine during a typical trip of 5 weeks away at sea. You might be shoveling 180 tons of coal, all of that below deck, you would be roasting from the conditions you were working in. But if you came up above deck, often you'd be freezing in any sort of winter weather. So it was a very difficult job for all concerned. And the important thing is, I suppose, is that despite these difficulties, they managed to take large quantities of fish and, in fact, keep particularly the Billingsgate market fed with a lot of its fresh fish on a daily basis.
You mentioned in your feature that the boxing fleets played an important role in times of war. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. The role of fishermen in wartime has been greatly neglected. When the First World War came about, many people thought it would result in, at sea at least, in a major battle between the dreadnoughts of both sides, the huge battleships. And, of course, there was a Battle of Jutland, but people are still arguing about who won that battle and what the outcome was. The vessels that were out there day after day, week after week, sweeping the mines from the sea lanes to keep the shipping lanes to Britain open, and many of the vessels on patrol service duties against the U-boats, these were fishing vessels, often manned by fishermen, and they had an extremely difficult job. They were armed with very limited weapons, but they had to sweep the mines from the sea, and this was a particularly difficult job because, of course, to sweep mines, you had to enter the minefield and cut the mines free from the bottom and then destroy them. So an incredibly difficult job in the First World War. Many of the auto handlers from the boxing fleets provided a great job in terms of keeping our sea lanes open and keeping Britain in the war, and their role has often been forgotten.
I mean, you mentioned in the piece one particular incident with the Russian forces. Can you tell us maybe that story?
Yeah, sure. One of the most spectacular peacetime events almost led to a war. In 1904, on the eve of the 99th anniversary of the Battle of Trafalgar, warships of the Russian Baltic Fleet opened fire on one of these boxing fleets far out in the North Sea. The attack was totally unprovoked. These were a group of peaceful, unarmed vessels going about the normal business. Mm-hmm. Why did the Russians attack them? Well, the Russians were at that time at war with the Japanese, and they were sending their Baltic fleet all the way round to the Pacific to take on the Japanese. For some reason, when they came across this fleet of trawlers in the North Sea, they mistook them for Japanese torpedo boats and opened fire. It was an enormous diplomatic incident. Mm. It nearly led to a war.
And I assume quite a few people were injured during the event.
Well, I don't think the Russians could have been that good at the firepower in those days, because although they fired on the trawlers for 20 minutes, only one of the trawlers was sunk. Three of the crew succumbed to their injuries. But the event itself, you know, the affront to British naval pride was such that it did, for a moment, seem that we would be at war with the Russians. In fact, we didn't. And the Russians continued their tortuous journey east. Not surprisingly, that Russian fleet was then destroyed by Admiral Tojo at the Battle of Tsushima many months later.
OK, I mean, the images that you have included in the feature are really quite remarkable. I mean, partly for their historical value, but also from a photographical point of view. What do you know about the pictures and their creator?
Well, one of the most interesting things about the pictures themselves, which were acquired by James Morley at an auction, the fact that they were a collection. They were quite clearly somebody who'd gone out to the boxing fleet and had taken all these images and then had spent a great deal of time tinting them. And whoever did that, whoever gave them the colour, had a remarkable eye for the nature of the sea and the time when he was out there with the fleets. And we were particularly intrigued by these. A lot of them were quite informal, but different to your normal Edwardian sort of photograph of working people. And so we were quite keen to find out much more about them. And thanks to the help of Skipper Ken Knox, an acquaintance of mine, an ex-trawlerman, we managed to track these down. We found that some of them had been used in Toil of the Deep magazine, which again is a Mission for Deep Sea Fishermen's magazine. And what we believe happened is this chap, we found he was called S.A. Davy, but we don't know much more about him personally. But what he must have done was sail from London, from Billingsgate, London, one of the steam cutters, out to the fleet. He would have only had one of those old-fashioned box cameras. Mm-hmm. And he took this remarkable set of images, brought them back, presumably coloured them in, and I would imagine probably used them for lectures as a magic lantern show. And then, of course, over time, they would be forgotten, left in a box, and hence many, many years they came up for auction.
Thank goodness they were found.
They're remarkable, and it was really good that they were found, because these are unusual. You don't get that depth of image of what's going on with the boxing fleets in any other way at that time.
What actually happened to the boxing fleets?
Well, the boxing fleets continued to work down to the First World War. During the First World War, as we said, there were many of the vessels were in action against Germany and German vessels, and quite a number were lost during the war. After the war, the owners of the four boxing fleets that had been before the war regrouped them into two fleets. But by the interwar period, the North Sea fish stocks were declining. They weren't making the yields that they were making before the war. And many of the larger trawler owners were also interested in what's called distant water trawling. That would mean sending vessels off to Iceland or to the Faroe Islands. So they never reinvested in the boxing fleets. They kept the fleets going themselves until 1936. And then the final boxing fleets were wound up and sold off in that year. It wasn't quite the end of the boxing fleet. Some of the vessels went on to do other work, and one of them still survives to this day, the steam trawler Viola, which lies at Gritvikan in South Georgia. It's now known as the Dias, and it really has had a remarkable life because it was engaged in the sinking of two U-boats. It later was sold off to Norwegian owners and ended up in the South Atlantic, where apart from being a seal hunting ship, was used for exploration for over 40 years, and it still survives, as I say, to this day.
That was Rob Robinson on 19th century boxing fleets. You can read Rob's feature in our January issue, as well as take a closer look at some of the remarkable images. His new book, Far Horizons, From Hull to the Ends of the Earth, is out now.
Now for the last interview. This month, the BBC is showing its landmark series, A History of Ancient Britain. With that in mind, Dave made the trip to the Neolithic Monument of Avebury in Wiltshire to discuss the story of the place with National Trust archaeologist Nicholas Nashall.
We're sat in the courtyard of the museum part of Avebury on a lovely November day, and not too many people about, so it's quite surprising. I guess in summer it gets a bit busy here.
It does, yes. We can be absolutely heaving. We do get hundreds of thousands of visitors every year here, and at this time of year, it does tend to quiet down a little.
And people come presumably because, well, it's a World Heritage site, so it's pretty famous and people know that it's...
Absolutely. Avebury's one of those places that people from all across the globe will visit, partially because of the World Heritage Site status and partially because I think people are quite aware of the vast size of the monument here. We've got the huge henge which partially encloses a modern village, and we also have the largest prehistoric stone circle in the world.
So let's talk about that. So we've got the henge and the stone circle, as you say, and lots of other stuff as well. So we've got this massive big henge, and as you drive into the village, that's the first thing you see, with this enormous big earthwork in front of you. And then we've got the stone circle within that, and lots of stone rows and things emanating from it. So which comes first, the henge or the stones inside?
As far as we're aware, one of the earliest parts of the monuments at Avebury itself, there's a very small version of the very large bank that you see today, which runs around on the same footprint, and that seems to be one of the earliest parts of the site. And we think, by analogy with other sites, that's probably constructed around about 3000 BC. But we've learned recently from some works to... the what's known as the backstone of the cove, which is part of one of the central settings of the site in what's known as the northern inner circle, that the largest stone there, which weighs about 100 tonnes, so it's the largest standing stone still standing in the British Isles,
right?
In terms of its weight, that is, that we think was probably put up sometime centering around those years, about 3000 BC again. So again, that could be a very early component. But much of the stone circles do seem to have been put up probably around about 2600 BC.
Okay.
It's a little later.
Perhaps we ought to clarify what a henge is. It's an archaeological construct, isn't it? It's something that archaeologists talk about. It's not necessarily something that people in prehistory would have necessarily talked about. So what does an archaeologist understand by a henge?
Well, for an archaeologist, a henge is a circular or a subcircular monument in plan. They can have anywhere between one and four entrances. The important thing about a henge is that you have a bank, but you have a ditch inside it. So that means that essentially it's not a defensive earthwork. If we think of something like Roman forts or Iron Age hill forts, you would expect to find a bank with a ditch or ditches outside of it. That makes much more sense for defence. But with a henge, it's a sort of act of enclosing rather than something to defend from the outside.
Mm. And henges aren't necessarily associated with stone circles. They can be, but archaeologists see them as two separate monuments that sometimes come together.
Absolutely. I think confusion sometimes arises because of the name of Stonehenge, which, curiously enough, isn't really a henge monument at all.
Yeah.
But they are indeed two separate things, and as you say, they do sometimes come together. They occur often at around about the same time. So you're looking with henge monuments, they start to be constructed around about 3000 BC. But we do know some of the later ones go on into the Bronze Age in terms of their construction. As we learn more about henges from various sites, it seems that henges are involved more with the idea of closing off a special space or memorialising an effort or works that have gone on before. So sometimes that might be stone circles, or sometimes in the case of the recent discoveries that the Stonehenge Riverside Project have made down at Durrington Walls, that might be a part or parts of the village in that case that was used by the workers who were constructing the Sarsen phases of Stonehenge. So it's, if you like, memorialising or monumentalising and setting aside something that's special or powerful.
Mm. And when they're enclosing these areas or trying to set aside these areas for whatever they're trying to do, there's an idea that perhaps sometimes it was the act of actually making the boundary rather than then what happened next that was the important thing. Do you stand with that?
I certainly think it's true that the enormous effort, I mean millions of person hours in the construction of some of these larger henge monuments, would have gone into their construction, the digging of the ditches. And bearing in mind that when people were making these things, they were using stone tools and organic materials, antler picks. So the effort that went into them must have been related to the importance of the sites themselves. I certainly think that much is true. So in that sense, the digging of the boundaries is important. But I do think that the bounding off of the areas as well probably has a significance to it.
So what we've got at the moment is quite a substantial earthwork and then quite a substantial ditch. But I guess, given the course of time, it's changed from its how it was originally. It would have been a much steeper-sided ditch and perhaps much more daunting for people looking at it.
Very much so. When people look at the ditch of the Avebury Henge today, it looks pretty magnificent, huge. But in actual fact, we know that from Harold St. George Gray's excavations, as much as anybody else in the early years of the 20th century, he put sections through the ditch. And what he found was that in places, these things are twice as deep again as they appear today. So you're looking at something up to about 9 metres in depth, probably. So absolutely enormous. And as you say, much straighter in the sides, because over the years, what has happened is that the sides of the ditch have obviously eroded away with time. And human beings, what they are, is we've got a village that grew up within part of the henge. What happens is that people start throwing their rubbish into the henge ditches. So they begin to fill up essentially as a sort of midden site or a medieval landfill, if you like.
Okay. Okay, and so then on to the stones. So we've got this large collection of stones in and around here. Now, am I right in thinking that most of these stones, or all of these stones, are from around here? They haven't been transported any great distance.
That's right. The Marlborough Downs and the area around here has been, in the past, in the post-medieval period, was the centre for what was known as the sarsen breaking industry. Mm. And the sarsens are these huge grey stones, which are what our stone circles and our stone avenues here are made of. And in fact, it's also what the great trilithons that Stonehenge are constructed of as well. But we know that prior to this sarsen breaking industry, there were much more extensive sarsen fields all over the Marlborough Downs, and you can still see some of them today at places like Lockeridge Dean, just down near the modern A4, and up on Fifield and Overton Downs today, just a short distance from the Henge itself.
Yeah, so there were actually, so it would have been that the land would have been littered with stones, basically.
It would have been, yes. I think they would have been sort of all over the landscape, including in some cases the area immediately around where the Henge, and particularly the West Kennet Avenue, is today.
So what, when an average visitor comes here, someone who hasn't studied prehistory to any great depth comes here, what can they hope to sort of understand about the people who made these sites by just visiting and wandering around? What can they really learn?
We're very lucky that we have the museum that relates to the sites themselves right here in the middle of the landscape, and in fact part of the museum, the barn gallery of the museum, is actually cut into the back of the Henge Bank, so it's literally part of the monuments. What that means is that if you want to come here and really appreciate these monuments and get a basic understanding of how things work, I would say the best place to start is to look in our museum galleries, which have, obviously, we have the artefacts here which are on display, but we also have sort of interactive presentations and a display showing you the development of both the landscape through time and the work of those who've come before, people like me, who were working as archaeologists and antiquaries to try and understand the place. Mm. So if you start there, I think you can get a really good understanding of what this whole landscape is about, because of course it goes far beyond the Henge and Stone Circles itself. We have Windmill Hill, as you say, the causewayed enclosure. We've got West Kennet Long Barrow, the chambered tomb, which is roughly the same date as Windmill Hill. We've got the West Kennet Avenue, as you say. We have the sanctuary, but we also have hundreds of barrows in this landscape. So just the portion that the National Trust looks after, just to give you an idea, we have 34 different sets of scheduled monuments, and we look after 1,600 acres, and we care for just a little under a third, probably, of the World Heritage Site, this half of the World Heritage Site, because we're jointly inscribed with Stonehenge. Hmm. We also look after parts of the Stonehenge landscape as well. So it does, the archaeology extends over a huge area. And we shouldn't forget, as well as all this wonderful prehistory that we have here, one of the glories of Avebury is that, if you like, our timeline extends right through from earliest prehistory, virtually, into the Roman and the Saxon periods. We have a very important early Saxon settlement here. We've got Saxon activity in the church as well. So we get an awful lot of time depth. We do a lot of time at Avebury.
Mm. Okay, so just to finish up, as someone who works here, comes here every day, what would you suggest that someone visiting here should most, you know, should make a beeline for? What should they have a look at and really try and enjoy and understand?
I would definitely say come to the museum, because then you're able to make your own choices about it and learn. I think you gain a lot by learning a little bit more about the place. But if you want to come and be awed and impressed, then I would suggest you make your way to the Cove Stone, stand in front of that stone and just think to yourself that that weighed 100 tonnes. It was put up probably somewhere around 5,000 years ago with people without the use of metal tools and implements. And it's been calculated in the past that some of our more average stones of about 30 to 40 tonnes took 200 people to put up. So just wonder for a moment how many people and how much effort it took to put up that huge backstone.
The National Trust manages the World Heritage Site of Avebury, and you can get more information about visiting it at www.nationaltrust.org.uk. The BBC Two series, A History of Ancient Britain, presented by Neil Oliver, is showing this month. And we have a feature on Neolithic stone circles and henges in the January issue of BBC History magazine.
BBC History magazine is published every 4 weeks in the UK and costs £3.80. Look out for it in your local newsagent or supermarket, or take advantage of one of our great subscription deals, whether you're in the UK or overseas. Details are in the magazine and on our website at www.historyextra.com.
Well, that's it for January. Next month we have Simon Sebag-Montefiore on Jerusalem, a look at the life of Walter Raleigh, and a review of the impact of the Black Death on medieval Britain.